because we are living in a chemical world, and I'm a chemical nondescript person. We are living in a chemical world, and I am a chemical girl. We are living in a chemical world, and I am a chemical girl or boy. We are living in a chemical world, and I am a chemical.
Hi, I'm Kenna Crampton, Membership Director at KDNK Community Radio, and this is Chemical World.
Hi, I'm Maggie Saldine, Peer Recovery Coach with MindSprings Health, here to chat with you today, Kenna, about chemicals and stuff.
This is our third episode of Chemical World, and last week we gave you some background of all of kind of where drugs come from. Why they have created so much conflict in the world, and also the connection between racism in the country, in this country, and how our drug laws are oppressive.
Yeah, so last week we definitely had a lot of history, a lot of facts, but for this episode, I wanted to spread the word about August being Overdose Awareness Month, and August 31st is International Overdose Awareness Day. So in honor of that, I wanted to come in and talk about harm reduction.
So as peer recovery coach at MindSprings Health, right now what you really want to focus on is teaching the community about what harm reduction. Is that right?
Yeah, and just teaching the community about what I do. And so I think that a great way to get started is to, rather than go into the specifics of my job right away, I kind of want to give you an introduction to what harm reduction means. So harm reduction in general is a set of strategies and approaches that we use in our everyday lives to reduce the negative consequences of our actions. So great examples of harm reduction are wearing seatbelts, sunscreen, condoms.
Masks.
Yeah, yes, great. Great one. We are reducing the harm of being outside by wearing our masks, right? So in terms of substance abuse, harm reduction strategies seek to reduce the serious negative consequences that drug use can have on both individuals and the community, such as the spread of infectious diseases, overdose deaths, lost productivity, and costs associated with the healthcare and justice systems.
So I have a question. How does harm reduction help with loss of productivity?
So some of the harm reduction strategies that I'm going to talk about today are all proven to be really effective ways of getting people who have opioid use disorder or other substance use issues back into the life they led before those issues developed. So lost productivity is a negative consequence of drug use because people who overdose and die early in their lives, we lose like 50 years of productivity that's used in that data, right? People who are missing work because they have to travel to methadone clinics or because they're having medical issues. These are all ways that drug use can lead to lost productivity. And so the harm reduction methods have just been more effective at helping individuals get onto the right track in their lives so that they can be more productive community members, so that they can be the best employees they can be. They can be the best parents and, you know, daughters and sons and siblings, and they can just give more back than they would otherwise, because a lot of people living in addiction struggle with maintaining familial responsibilities, maintaining work responsibilities. And so that's where we lose productivity. That's where we have healthcare costs and things like that that are affecting all of us through taxes.
And with being less productive brings on depression, which then creates the cycle of not feeling good about yourself because you're not being productive. So then you continue on with not being productive. And that's another reason why with AA, a big part of it is charity work, right? Because there's giving back to your community, which feels good. It's like almost a high in itself.
Yeah. And that, I think, ties back to, I think we talked about this in the first episode a little bit, that substance abuse and mental health issues usually happen together. Mm-hmm. But it's a very vicious cycle because you might have had depression and now you have a substance abuse disorder and now that's causing anxiety. Or, you know, you might have had some anxiety and now you have a substance abuse disorder and it's causing depression. And so it's a very cyclical relationship between mental well-being and the things that we put in our bodies.
Yeah. And you had said at one point that there's this universal anxiety going on. And I kind of just want to say I've been feeling that a lot lately. Like, I'm doing the things that I normally need to do to keep myself sober, keep myself happy. And I can't help but have this anxiety that has been taking over a little bit. And it's been a little hard to get through, I just have to say, because I don't know if anybody else is feeling that, but I am feeling that universal anxiety.
Yeah, and what Kenna's talking about is a lot of the holistic people that I follow in the, you know, yoga and astrology and just all sorts of fields have been talking about this concept of, like, you know, you may be familiar with the collective conscious or the collective unconscious. Well, the idea of collective anxiety, and I definitely felt that. I can't believe it was 2 years ago now, but during the late Christine fires, I was really, you know, relatively far away, but I was like really having a lot of anxiety at that time. And then now, of course, it makes sense that there is gonna be some anxiety out there. And it was funny because on Friday night, Kenna and I talked about it later, and we had both been experiencing anxiety at the exact same time and we didn't know why. And it's just, you know, it's hard when there's no real succinct leadership, when everyone is saying something different. That's a huge thing we have in this country already, is every county has different laws, every state has different laws, so it can be really confusing. And amid COVID, all the more confusing. So yeah, don't be afraid to reach out for help. Don't think that you're going through this alone just because you might be physically alone, because we are definitely all in this together. So moving back to harm reduction. So I kind of wanted to, somewhere in there, I felt like this stat worked well. So about 95% of Americans use some form of mind-altering substance on a regular basis. Like our lovely theme song suggests, some people use caffeine, some people it's alcohol. You know, caffeine is actually like insanely prevalent. Like we don't really, I feel like I didn't realize. Like caffeine's in chocolate. Mm. And children and adolescents consume more soda than anyone else, and like more sports drinks. And so it's just really interesting that we as a culture think that that's acceptable for our kids to be hopped up on caffeine and sugar for that matter. You know, I don't remember the exact numbers, but the rates of, you know, 2 to 4 year olds, how much caffeine they get every day. It's pretty remarkable. And so harm reduction acknowledges that people use substances and it's not going to stop if we just ignore it. And that sometimes substance use has the potential to cause serious harm. So rather than ignoring or condemning drug use, harm reduction approaches use a non-judgmental, client-centered approach that focuses on individual choice, autonomy, and empowerment. So rather than having 100% abstinence be the goal, harm reduction usually has the goal of a better quality of life. So like I was saying, getting you back to what I hear a lot is back to what you were before your substance use, before your addiction, before that prescription of Percocet that your doctor gave you for your wisdom teeth. Mm-hmm. We want to get you back to that. And so for me, my number one things that I want to ask when I meet with a new person is, tell me about your use and tell me about your goals. And with those pieces of information, I can help you find the program that's going to work the best for you.
Yeah, I also I listened to Dan Savage, the Savage Love Cast, and he had the Deputy Commissioner for Disease Control at New York City Health Department, Dr. Dimitri Discalakis. I'm not saying that right, but he just said he was talking about harm reduction with HIV, and the way that he was speaking about it, I felt obviously was so was related so well to what we're talking about. And he said this one line that I had to write down because I thought it was so well said, that we're looking at harm reduction as opposed to harm elimination.
Yeah, that's great. And because, of course, I mean, in everything in life, like with all the speed limits we set, with all the seatbelts and different laws that come out all the time, because that's another really interesting one. Like, that's all really new. There's plenty of people alive who remember not having speed limits, not having seatbelts, things like that.
Even seeing children that are, you know, 4 or 5 or maybe even 6. I don't know. It's about weight, but sitting in car seats still, booster seats. And,
right.
You know, when we were that age, we weren't even us who are not that old, were not sitting in booster seats. You know, we weren't sitting in car seats till after we were, what, 2? I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, you think back, the car has only been, you know, really popular for a little over 100 years, and when it started there was no doors or roof. You got your babies just flying around wherever. So, but of course my point is we can't eliminate every car accident, right? We just do these things to reduce the impact of car accidents when they happen, because we know that they're going to happen, right? So that's a really great just comparison for dealing with it in the world of substance abuse. So I want to, before I move on, just talk about what the 3 pillars of harm reduction are, the 3 programs or strategies that are most common with harm reduction. And this is really specifically with opioid use disorder. So medication-assisted treatment, that is getting connected with a doctor and a counselor. So you're on a medication, whether it's methadone or Suboxone, and you're seeing a counselor regularly. So that's medication-assisted treatment. The second pillar of harm reduction is access to naloxone or Narcan, which we talked a little bit about before, and I will keep talking about a lot. And then syringe access programs. So different cities, you see different things. You'll hear needle exchange. There's a one-to-one where you have to bring in syringes to get clean ones. And then there's just syringe access, where you can dispose of your old syringes and you can get clean ones, but you don't necessarily need to dispose of old ones. But anyway, those programs, they do a lot more than just provide clean syringes. They provide educational literature on how to use safely. Dan Savage's focus on harm reduction and HIV, I mean, we talked a little bit about the community effects of substance abuse, but those individual negative consequences that I look at are those overdose deaths, HIV, and hepatitis C. And all 3 of those, we've seen drastic increases in not just Colorado, but our counties in the past few years, but slowly over the past 20 years for sure, and even more over the past couple of years. So those are our main things that we want to address in harm reduction with opioid use disorder, and also wound care, because anytime you open up your skin, you have the potential for getting infected. So these are the programs that we use within harm reduction to mitigate those negative consequences. And these programs, they can sound really scary, but they have been in practice for years all around the country, and they have been empirically proven to do a variety of things.
Can we get you to give us some places, maybe some websites or some literature that people can look at to get some of these numbers so they can see how successful these harm reduction programs are, such as syringe access programs?
Cool. And I'll talk a little bit about the end of the episode about more opportunities to learn more. But the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, is the best place to get your numbers from. And all of these programs are endorsed by the World Health Organization, by the Center for Disease Control, because they've all been empirically proven to reduce crime, and specifically violent crime, to reduce the spread of disease, to reduce the risk that community members and police officers specifically could get stuck by syringes. They have been proven to get more people into recovery programs, and those people have lower recidivism rates. So to say again, people who utilize harm reduction programs are more likely to get into a recovery program and stay sober longer than their counterparts who get into treatment through the criminal justice system or are somehow mandated into recovery. So these programs are really, really effective at getting people help. And part of that is because here in Colorado, we have a 68% treatment gap, meaning that for every 10 people who are ready to enter recovery, only about 3 can. So there are so many barriers to getting into an actual rehab. And one of those is that even if you wanted to, you probably couldn't. And so we have to have other programs in place. We need to have safety nets to help these people until they can get into that treatment. And that's where harm reduction comes into play.
And again, this is not a show that is only about plugging for AA. But I always want to just mention that AA is a great free option for recovery if you can't afford rehab, which most of us can't. And they're just, it's a great program.
Yeah, and it's just a great support system, even if you feel like you're having a hard day and just need some support. And the fact that nowadays everything is in Zoom, it just makes it so easy. And there's a really easy website. If you you could just Google like AA meetings in Carbondale or Glenwood or wherever, or I think it's the 14th District, and you'll find all of the AA meetings from Aspen to Rifle to Eagle, and they're all going to be pretty much on Zoom right now.
And of course, that goes for everywhere throughout the country as well. So just,
yeah, you could find them.
Just Google AA near me, like you would if you were looking for a restaurant.
Yeah, and that's so funny. Like I keep talking about AA, and I'm like, oh, you don't even have to go to your home meeting. It doesn't even matter. You can go anywhere right now, which is so cool, and you can check out. Because I think that there are so many different kinds of AA. There's women's group. There's men's group. There's age, you know, demographics, restrictions, whatever. There's all sorts of different kinds of groups. Then there's, you know, groups that are really specific to NA, or like we talked about, you have your Al-Anon meetings for families and things like that. And so I think it's good, too, if you're not sure, to try out a couple and find the right ones. And, you know, even a meeting in Carbondale is going to be different than one in Glenwood or Rifle or Aspen, and just finding the right vibe for you.
Mm-hmm. And did we touch on the third pillar of harm reduction?
Yeah, that was syringe access programs, but I was just reviewing my notes, and I just want, there is one other piece that I didn't say that connects specifically to syringe access. And again, like, it sounds scary. A lot of people think, oh, I don't want these programs because it's going to bring crime and it's going to bring, you know, drug use. But in reality, it's just, you know, where these places usually are, the drug use is already happening. And what it does is it keeps paraphernalia off the streets. It keeps our parks clean. It protects the public from the risk that they're going to run into somebody who has overdosed in public. You know, these programs are designed to protect our communities and everyone in them.
And we can't ignore the fact that the more you push someone away or judge them for doing something that you find wrong, it makes them want to do it more. And it's so frustrating because I wish I wasn't that way. And I can look back and know that just the more someone judges me for doing something or tells me that I shouldn't do something, it's just the more I just want to do it. And I think we can't ignore that instinct that people have. And so there's that, you know, no judgment means maybe less people are doing it out of spite.
Yeah, that's so true. And it is so silly how it is a natural part of us. I know I shared this with Kenna that my aunt recently told me that I need to tell her before I get a face tattoo. And then she said, well, I'll just tell you, you can't get one. Well, I'm 29 years old, and you'd think I wouldn't have a rebellious streak, but I think the fact that I'm 29 years old and somebody was trying to tell me what I can and can't do, I don't want a face tattoo, but now I do because she said that. And so it is. It's just good to keep that in mind, that, and especially when we're talking to teens and substance abusers, but anyone, right? Like, you go to the doctor and you want to have a say in how your care is handled, right? And again, these are all new things. It's so funny. I was watching this cartoon last night based in the 70s, and it was like Lamaze was a brand new concept. And it is just crazy. Like, we really have to work to be our own advocates in our healthcare sometimes, because that is still a newer theme in the medical world, is to let the clients be the expert on themselves, but they are at the end of the day. And so with my work, it's really, you know, I'm not somebody from the outside coming in telling people how things need to be done. I'm somebody who's a part of this community, and I want to ask people what they want, because telling people what they need is just, it's going to hurt everybody, because nobody's going to be successful, the provider or the client, in that situation. So another thing I wanted to address in honor of Overdose Awareness Month is I have a list here of the three major reasons why people overdose, specifically with heroin and meth and cocaine. So the three major reasons why people will overdose are, number one, drug quality impurity, number two, periods of abstinence, and number three, using alone. So we'll go over those all quickly. So drug quality and purity. So this is something we kind of addressed a little bit in the conversation about fentanyl. There are some resources that exist out there where you can order like drug testing strips so you can be sure what you have. So like say you can test your heroin, and if you find out it has fentanyl, you can maybe use a little bit less or something like that. I would refer you to Google these things and find the companies that produce those strips if that's something you're interested in. But in addition to fentanyl being a huge problem in the injection drug using community, you never know what's in your drugs, right?
Yeah, and you mentioned sometimes people put cow bones or baby laxatives. Of course, those aren't going to do a whole lot of harm, but there's so many other things that are powder and white or dark and black or whatever it is that you need to mix to make your drug expand so the drug dealer is making more money. It can be so dangerous and so scary. And I also, just going off on this, have to say one reason why it's kind of nice that we have legal marijuana, because you know that you're getting pure marijuana, whereas there was always that chance before. If you're buying your marijuana from a drug dealer, you don't know. Maybe they weighed it on a scale that has other drugs on it or something creepy like that. Now you can go to the store and buy pure marijuana, which is nice.
Yeah, and that's also like a concern when you're sharing with other people. If it's their product, you might not know if somebody like just likes to put PCP in their marijuana or something. Things like that happen, you know. And they do try to use chemicals that are safe for human consumption when they're cutting their drugs, because, of course, they want you to come back and buy more drugs. But the point is, like, we just don't know. We just don't know what's in our drugs. And that is one of the benefits of decriminalization, is once you have government control, then you have quality control over your substances. And another thing that's really common in the powder and pill drug world is sometimes there's just other drugs in it. And maybe mm-hmm. you didn't mm-hmm. want ecstasy cut with heroin, you know? Yeah. And that's something that's pretty common, which I don't know why you would mix those two. But, hey, it happens.
Yeah, especially like ecstasy and MDMA, you know, I mean, ecstasy, I feel that's sort of that big difference, is ecstasy is cut with heroin or speed or whatever, whereas MDMA, also known as Molly, is more pure, or supposedly.
Yeah, and that's
you can test it.
That's a good one that you bring up, because I think that that's a very specific drug that has a lot of issues with quality control, because technically ecstasy and Molly are the same thing, because they're technically both just supposed to be MDMA, but they're definitely not. They're definitely mixes. And I remember when I first heard of Molly, this is like almost 20 years ago, and the way, like, somebody described it to me, like, it was just a mix of, like, mushrooms and acid and ecstasy and all these different things, and so, like, I didn't understand what it was then, and I just thought that was interesting. If you look in the most current textbook on this stuff, technically they're the same, but it's that drug purity that makes them different, because, yeah, ecstasy is usually cut with other things. Molly is usually pure MDMA, but it just, we don't ever know. And when we don't know what's in our drugs, just like if we don't know what's in our food, it can create problems. And that's a specific issue with the whole heroin and fentanyl debacle, but it definitely crosses over. And I think that the world of MDMA is a place where it gets really sketchy to me because, yeah, you really just don't know half the time what you're taking. So,
and I agree that it does get very sketchy. In my experience taking ecstasy and MDMA or Molly, I've gotten really, really, really sick taking ecstasy and not taking Molly. Like with Molly, I always have a good time and it's okay, or have had a good time and it's okay. Whereas when I've taken ecstasy, pretty every single time I have gotten ill and sick and not good.
Yeah, that's so interesting because it's like you probably, it was multiple times from multiple sources, right? It's not like it's the same one. And I could be like, oh, it was probably cut with heroin and that's what made you sick. That's so strange. And yeah, that one, it really is interesting to me because if I tell people in the drug using community that Molly and ecstasy are the same thing, they're like, oh, no, no, that's not, obviously. But it is supposed to be the same thing. And so MDMA and its multiple offspring is definitely an interesting one in terms of drug quality. So I have a MDMA purity story to share that I think is pretty funny. When I was 18, somebody gave me some pills that they said were ecstasy. And I kind of knew right away that it was not like any ecstasy I'd ever seen before. But, you know, I was 18. I was young. But they were like these clear gel caps that looked like they were filled with sand. So that was my first hint that it was like something else. And then when I took it, I was like, oh, this is not ecstasy. This is some kind of hallucinogen, which interestingly enough, ecstasy is a hallucinogen. And I now know MDMA is a hallucinogen. Hallucinogen is a really, really interesting drug group because we pretty much put whatever we don't know where else to put it. We put it there. So like ketamine, PCP, GHB, like a lot of things that we just don't know how to classify, wind up in that hallucinogen. I'm not really sure about GHB, but definitely PCP and ketamine are hallucinogens, and so are MDMA and its little nieces and nephews, ecstasy, Molly. And so I definitely did not think it was ecstasy in that moment. I thought that I had somehow been given like peyote or something. And I actually didn't find out until very recently. I mean, that was like 12 years ago now because it was right after my 18th birthday that that happened. But somebody who knew who gave me the drug was like, oh, no, he was selling sassafras at the time. Ooh. Have you heard of that before?
Yes, I have done sassafras before.
Like intentionally?
Yeah.
Okay. And I mean, it's just so weird because, yeah, it's like sometimes we're like, yeah, I've done that, but it was on accident or whatever. You know, it really happens more than you would think. And I've been past a bowl full of weed with crack on top. And like, it's weird the things people will mix. You just never know. But so it turns out in retrospect that it was sassafras, which is chemically MDA. And so it's similar to Molly. They say it's like gentler than Molly. But it's also like just known as like an older Molly because it comes from a plant and it's just been around longer.
Oh, I just love the name. I love the sassafras.
I actually think it's a fun name too. And Sally, I think that, yeah, it's just a fun drug. But taking it, I mean, if I had known that that's what I was taking, maybe it would have been a little more fun. I won't get into the details of how the rest of that night went, but it was just so funny to look back and now know and be like, oh, it was a hallucinogen. And I think that with ecstasy, Molly, and sassafras, things like that too, it's just there's a lot of cutting that happens, and it's also like these very subtle chemical differences sometimes. So there might actually be a chemical difference in the drug, but they're all like related to each other. And so that's just one of my many stories of I took something that was totally something else and I didn't even know what I took for a long time. And that's just in the world of MDMA. I think that we see that a lot.
It's kind of lucky that you were even able to find out what it was years later. I mean, like we were talking about my experiences with ecstasy, like I have zero idea where that drug came from. So I have zero idea what it was cut with or who to even approach to ask about what it was. But in my experience also with drug purity, I have come in contact with cocaine cut with meth. Mm-hmm. So just, it's out there. It's really, people cut drugs with all types of things and even other types of drugs. And when you say that the chemical makeup may just be one small thing, that small change can have a huge effect on a person's brain. So,
yeah, and you never know. And that's what's so scary when your drugs are coming from different sources all the time, especially, you know, if you don't have a dealer that you really trust and really know where it's coming from, you kind of never know. And yeah, like I've heard about allergic reactions because there's just different stuff cut into their ecstasy or whatever. And then I don't know if I mentioned this before, but, you know, this is becoming an increasing concern specifically with the opiate using community because just fentanyl is so lethal. Like, you know, if you get PCP in your weed, like you're going to have a bad time, but you'll probably like make it at least. You might wake up in jail, but, you know, you're going to live through that experience. Whereas if you think you're taking a Percocet, but it's actually fentanyl, you're going to die and never have had any idea what happened. So that's where it gets really scary. But an interesting almost benefit to that situation is that so now we're seeing fentanyl being cut into meth. And so people might have developed opioid dependence without ever knowingly have taken an opioid. And the reason I say that that's a benefit is because our medical science for opioid treatment for heroin users, Vicodin and Percocet users, fentanyl users, is just a lot more well-established. We have much better treatment options. And so if we're able to determine through a urinary analysis that this meth user actually has opioids in their system, we can provide them with a lot more services, whereas with stimulant users, we're just not there scientifically yet as well as we are with alcohol and heroin. So moving on to the second reason why people overdose is periods of abstinence. So usually following jail or rehab. It is really, really common, usually within 2 weeks, but the first time somebody uses after a period of sobriety for them to overdose. I'll talk a little bit more in our extra episode this month about like the science of why this happens. But basically, you built up a tolerance, you went to jail for 30 days, your tolerance is gone, but you're going to go back to shooting up the same amount that you were used to, and it's going to be too much. People who have been released from incarceration settings in the past 2 weeks are 129 times more likely to overdose than the general public.
That is a scary number, 129 times more likely. Wow. So that's just a little bit of a warning. If you know someone who uses, who's just gotten out of jail, just let them know if they're going to use, be careful.
Yeah, just to watch yourself. And it's so common after jail and rehab. And that's where we get a lot of our overdose deaths. And so, you know, I just use a little bit, just a little bit.
And I think just for people to be able to relate to that, you know, I mean, just because alcohol is legal and the majority of the population in the United States drink alcohol, you know, if you're above 21, you know, if you take a little break from drinking alcohol and then come back to it, you need to be more careful. And so relate it to how you feel if you've taken a break from drinking and start drinking again. You can tell those IPAs catch up to you a lot quicker than they did before.
Yeah, and I mean, every drug has a different tolerance level. Like they say that your tolerance for psychedelics like goes away in a couple days. But I think the main point here is that if you have a regular habit and you are gone for a while for whatever reason in this period of abstinence, you really can't go back to using the amount you were used to. You need to go back to the amount that you first started using when you first started using.
Or at least start from there.
Yeah, that's what you need to start from there. When you get back from your period of abstinence, take it slow. It's my advice. Not telling you, get out of jail, gotta stay sober. There are ways to be safe if you choose to use. So the third major reason why people overdose is because they're using alone, because there's a lot of shame and stigma associated with injection drug use and illicit substance use in general. People aren't really comfortable. It's so funny. I was talking to someone the other day about how even in Colorado, there's still a lot of stigma associated with marijuana. depending on who you talk to. And so even that, you know, and alcohol, and depending on who your friend group is, whatever, there can be a lot of shame, and you can be, you know, uncomfortable sharing with your friends what you're doing. But if you have a buddy and can stick with your buddy, it can really protect you. My thing there is that sometimes when you're using with friends, you can sometimes not know if you shared a needle with them. So using with a buddy, you always need to make sure you have your own stuff, your own works. If you're using injection drugs, you need to have your own needle, your own cook works, everything. And not be sharing with your friend. But when you two are there together, you can protect each other from overdose, because if somebody passes out and they're still, you know, responsive, but they're napping, you can turn them over on their side. If somebody full-on overdoses, you can give them Narcan or call the police. So using with other people and keeping that buddy system from childhood, I know that's probably really hard in COVID, but I mean, it's kind of, you know, take it back to the opium dens. It would actually protect people from overdose if they could feel comfortable to open up to a friend or family member, actually, especially if that person wasn't using, so that they can make sure someone is going to be there to help them if something goes wrong.
And you will touch on how exactly to recognize an overdose as opposed to just maybe using a little bit too much. But I do want to just say that the buddy program can also relate to if you're drinking alcohol as well. We may seem like we're really against alcohol, but we or alcohol use, but we are not. And we want to make sure that there's no judgment in anything. And if you're feeling like you're maybe drinking a little too much, talk to someone about it who you feel like will not judge you. That you can be in that safe place, because if you are feeling like you're drinking a little more than you normally do because it's COVID and you're feeling this universal anxiety, you're going to need to turn to the substance that you use to help calm your nerves, which for a lot of people, that is alcohol, and that is totally okay. But we will turn to those substances more than usual when we're feeling that extra anxiety. So I would encourage you to talk to someone who is not going to judge you and will just be able to talk to you about how you're feeling. So, and have a friend. It's better to drink with friends than alone.
Yeah, and we get it. Totally. Like you said, people drink. People use drugs. We don't care. It happens. We just want you to be safe. And definitely, I mean, drinking is another one where you definitely want to be with a buddy, because lots of things can go wrong when you're drinking, right? And another big one that, you know, this is a big theme, and I just want to throw this in there because I think it's important, and then I'll go on to talk about how to identify an overdose, is the a lot of the overdoses and a lot of the deaths that we're seeing nowadays is combinations of central nervous system depressants like alcohol, benzodiazepines, like Xanax and Valium, and opiates. And opiates does not just mean shooting up heroin. It could be your Percocet or morphine or Valium or fentanyl prescriptions that you got from your doctor. And like the most common way that people get started is by using an old prescription. So,
and that is so easy to, be prescribed Valium and something like Xanax, and also have alcohol be your substance of choice that you use to self-medicate in your own way. So it's pretty easy to drink alcohol, have a benzo in your system, and also an opiate. It's easier than it sounds.
Yeah, and that's why I bring it up, because that's the one combo that I would just really urge people to avoid as much as possible. I mean, obviously, you're not supposed to mix alcohol with those drugs. It happens, but it's really dangerous. It's more dangerous than doing any one of those things individually. And just because you can buy beer at the grocery store and get your Valium from the pharmacist doesn't mean that it's safe for you to be using them together. But yeah, if you're drinking, you know, that turning people onto their side piece is just as important, no matter what drug you're using. If somebody is asleep and they have been drinking or using drugs, you want to turn them on their side, because it's very common that people will vomit and choke on their vomit in their sleep. But when they're on their side, it kind of makes their airways a little more open. So if that does happen, they're less likely to choke.
Another personal story that has happened to me when drinking too much that I was needed to turn on to my side.
Well, I love hearing from people who have been saved in one way or another like that, because it's like, imagine if you weren't turned over and you weren't here with us now. Like, and I just think that hearing those stories from people in recovery is important, because it just illustrates how far people can go. That when you see somebody who's struggling, don't think, oh, they're a drug addict and they're never going to get better, because I was that person and look at me now. You know, I can help so many other people. So next, I want to talk about how to actually identify an overdose. And this is going to be specifically for opium. But in general, you could try these things with somebody, because it could be alcohol and benzodiazepines or whatever. This is basically just to identify if someone truly has overdosed. There's a difference between falling out and falling asleep. How do we know when someone is overdosed versus just really, really high? So someone who is overdosed may be exhibiting really shallow breathing or no breathing at all. They may seem like they're having some sort of seizure. They might be gurgling or making kind of weird guttural throat sounds. There might be movement. They also might be showing blue color in like their fingernails or lips, which is a sign that they're losing oxygen. So they may or may not have a pulse or breathing. If you're unsure because, say, somebody is breathing, they're gurgling, they're making weird sounds, the ways that you check to see, is this person really overdosing? So you want to say, hey, are you okay? Try to get some verbal reaction. If you don't get any verbal reaction, there is a method called the sternum rub, where you take your knuckles, so your hand balled into a fist, and the second knuckles, and you rub them along the person's sternum, so the area directly underneath and in between your breastplate, and you want to rub that area, or you can take the same knuckles and go right above their lips. Both of those things are really uncomfortable. If somebody has no reaction to those things, they have most likely overdosed, and at that point, you want to call 911. Or if you are a trained CPR or Narcan administer, you can provide emergency services at that time.
Again, that is when someone is overdosing. They will be showing signs of losing oxygen, blue lips, possibly blue on their nails, gurgling sounds, and very short breath or no breath. One way you can tell if someone is breathing is putting a mirror in front of their mouth or nose, and if it fogs up their breathing, you can probably tell how strong their breath is with that way as well. And also even just putting your hand underneath their nose, you'll feel if they're breathing, and then you can maybe go into the fist.
Yeah, and of course you can check someone's pulse on their wrist or behind their ear. It's actually pretty easy to find somebody's heart rate just by touching their body. You can usually feel it, right?
And we're saying that that's okay to do in COVID. You can touch someone's neck. And
well, I would put gloves on. I would have your gloves and mask. That's a great question. And, you know, in general in CPR training, I mean, some people who find someone who's unresponsive on the street, they want to wear gloves and some sort of mouth protector anyway.
Oh, of course. It's going to be different if it's a stranger than if it's your buddy.
But, yeah.
And what you've got available.
Yeah, and they make, too, just, you know, for everyone's reference, there are these, like, mouth guard things they have for CPR administration where you don't have to go mouth to mouth, but you can also administer CPR through a face mask. I understand that that's something people are probably not super comfortable with, especially right now, but I think preparing ourselves for what can we do in an emergency and still be protecting ourselves, there's definitely ways to do it. Plastic mouth guards are actually like either what I was just talking about, which is a like hard plastic piece that you put in their mouth and put your mouth over, or even just these plastic sheetings. They're designed for CPR because nobody wants to put their mouth on a stranger's mouth anytime.
Yeah, that's really cool. I didn't think about that. So you can give someone CPR while you're still wearing your mask.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, cool. Well, that's really good to know just in the age of COVID. At any point in time, if you ever need to give anybody CPR, you can give CPR with a mask on. That's great to know. I didn't even consider that, honestly.
The last training I was watching was talking about using a shirt as a barrier if you wanted to. And so that to me means a bandana, a gaiter, a face mask, whatever thing you have, you can give CPR to. I mean, that's still putting yourself at pretty high risk, but it's just, you know, what it's your choice what you want to do. You don't have to do it, and you can always call the police. So that was the majority of what I had wanted to address, because I really just wanted to bring a succinct, digestible introduction to harm reduction to the public affairs show. But if you want to learn more about any of this stuff, you can always check us out on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, and feel free to reach out to us with questions. Throughout the month of August, I will be both out in the community and online hosting some virtual events to spread awareness about overdose and what we can do to prevent it. So you can find me at the Basalt Sunday Markets on August 2nd, 9th, and 23rd from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. The Glenwood Springs Downtown Market on August 4th, 18th and 25th from 4 to 8 p.m. and at the Carbondale Farmers Market on August 5th, 19th and 26th from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. I'm also going to be presenting virtually at an event for overdose awareness hosted by Garfield County Public Libraries on August 17th. So that will be through Garfield County Public Libraries events page. So check their website out. And it will be from 6 to 7 p.m. And that will be a bilingual event in both English and Spanish, teaching more about harm reduction and overdose awareness. And finally, on August 31st, I will be doing a Facebook Live from the Mind Springs Facebook page. So just introducing myself to the community a little bit more. And there's also a statewide event. The Tri-County Overdose Prevention Partnership is hosting a Night of Remembrance virtually on August 31st from 6:30 to 8 p.m. And they're looking for stories from friends, families, and users who have been affected by overdose. So if you'd like to share or check out the event, go to IOAD, standing for International Overdose Awareness Day, IOAD2020.com. So there's a lot going on in August, and you definitely should follow us on Facebook to keep track of all these events and come find me in the community. I do have a really cool fun fact of the day in line with everything we just talked about on overdose prevention. So this one I learned from our soon-to-be chief of police, Kirk Wilson, who is super awesome. And he taught me that if you call the police to report a suspected overdose, you can't be charged for drug use or possession. So people who report overdoses and those who remain on the scene or at a medical facility with someone who has overdosed, those people are protected by the Good Samaritan laws in Colorado, and they can't face criminal prosecution for the use or possession of illicit substances and drug paraphernalia. And the law also extends to minors. So minors can't be charged for underage drinking or marijuana use if they call in a suspected overdose.
That is so great. And that is such great information, especially as we are really encouraging the buddy program. So please use the buddy program, have a friend, be with someone. If you know that someone is using or going to be drinking a little heavier than usual, be with them, hang out with them, don't judge them, because we're all having a hard time, and have a friend so they can call for help, vice versa too. And you can always call and help people. So remember, you can give CPR with a mask on, and you can call 911 if someone is overdosing, and you will not go to jail.
And I just really want to spread that message about calling it in, because I think especially in this day and age, none of us want to call the cops for anything if we can help it, right? But in reality, they're theoretically there to protect and serve, and we can help promote that positive relationship with our police force by being kind and respectful ourselves. And hopefully, you know, it's like the golden rule, treat other people the way you want to be treated. And I just want to get that out there. So I used to tell people, call it in, because you don't have to tell them what it is. Just call, say someone's unresponsive, and they'll send EMTs, and the police don't have to show up. But in reality, here in the Valley, the police are probably going to get there faster, and they're going to have Narcan. They're going to be able to reverse that overdose. They're not going to be able to charge you. Even if they try to intimidate you or try to write you some sort of ticket, you can take them to court. So just stay calm in that moment when you're interacting, because if you can stay calm and polite, you will have all the grounds to sue them later if they do something wrong. But this is the law. Call it in. Don't be afraid to call it in. I know it's really hard for us to accept this sometimes, but the police can help us when we need them to.
And at least for right now, the police are who you are going to call if someone is overdosing. 911 is the number to call if you are worried about anyone's safety. That's the we're
And the situation, and the situation, if you didn't live in a rural area, like I was saying, like the police don't have to come to an overdose. But in this valley, in this situation, they're probably going to be able to help you faster than the EMS, the emergency medical services, are.
Yeah. And again, minors, I want to remind you that if you think someone has overdosed, please call 911. You will not get in trouble. Thank you for listening. Thank you, Maggie, for being my co-host on Chemical World. It is such a pleasure to record and just talk to you. I love talking to you. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter to stay up to date. There will be an extra episode on August 24th, The Science of Addiction, How Our Bodies and Drugs Affect Each Other. And our next public affairs show will be September 14th at 4:30 here on KDNK. And for all of the extended versions of all of our episodes, they are available at kdnk.org or wherever you listen to podcasts. And be sure to subscribe to Chemical World.
And as always, I am Maggie Saldine, a peer recovery coach with Mind Springs Health, wishing you a safe and happy Overdose Awareness Month. And remember, you can always reach out to me with questions about substance abuse or any of the topics we discuss on Chemical World at my phone number, 970-531-5060, or my email, msaldine@mindspringshealth.org. And if you're unsure how to spell that, you can find it on kdnk.org.
Thank you, and remember that you do not have to be sober
to keep your community clean.
Aww.
Some boys tell me that they're clean, but that's not enough for me. I always use my own works to avoid getting HIV. When somebody passes out, make sure to turn them on their side. And anytime you're shooting up, make sure Narcan's inside. 'Cause we are living in a chemical world, and I am a chemical girl or boy, we are living.